The decision to parole Gary, to release him from his life sentence early, was made in July of 1981. That's 7 years, give or take, after he was first arrested for Grace's murder. Gary says that after his last habeas was denied in 1978, he gave up on ever getting free through the legal system and focused all his efforts on obtaining parole. He got a job as a runaround in Floyd County, which means that he was responsible for cleaning county property, like the police station, which meant he had access to phones during the day because he was running around cleaning up after others and had free run, essentially, of the police station. So he could make calls, have contact with the outside world, and he asked for people to write letters to the Georgia Board of Pardon Paroles to consider his early release. The effort, remarkably, seems to have paid off. Technically, Gary was eligible for parole in August of 1981, because back then, even if you're serving a life sentence, you first came up for consideration after 7 years. So when the parole board made the decision, 6 years and 11 months after Gary was first arrested, to release him on parole, well, that kind of fits. When I first talked to Gary, he seemed confident that it was his letter-writing campaign, the show of significant community support that had made the difference, that had won his release, and that even though it's fairly odd for someone on a life sentence to be released a mere 7 years in, it can happen, and that's why it happened here. I had several questions, though, because there had been other events happening in that time period that seemed closely related to Gary's case, and I kept wondering if they were related to his release as well. First, at some point that spring or summer, before Gary was released, Floyd County Officer Jerry Boyd had pulled Gary aside to tell him that the GBI had an informant, and the informant said that he hadn't even been there when Grace was killed. Second, in June 1981, one of the people who'd been in the house on the night of Grace's murder, but had never been questioned by police, was himself convicted of the murder and given a life sentence. Beau Salmon, Charlotte's boyfriend at the time, had been charged with killing Henry Ridley Jr. in 1981 as part of a murder-for-hire scheme, and his conviction would only come a month before the Pardon and Parole Board decided to release Gary. And third, not long before Gary was released, Gary talked to a GBI agent, and the agent told him that Beau had been involved in 7 or 8 murders, not just the murder of the Ridley boy. Though, after Beau had been given the life sentence, no other charges were ever brought against him. And maybe all of this was just a giant coincidence. Maybe it just happened that Beau's conviction and the GBI's informant all happened right at the same time that Gary's 7 years in prison were up and he first came up for parole. Maybe nothing in Murray and Whitfield counties had anything to do with Floyd County. But coincidence or not, I had to at least try to look into it. Because if nothing else, I needed to know more about this informant that Officer Jerry Boyd had told Gary about, the one who said that Gary hadn't even been there when Grace was killed. And that's why I ended up tracking down everything I could find about the Henry Ridley Jr. case. If there was an informant, it seemed likely that it was connected to that case somehow. And when I started this search, I thought I had a good guess about who the informant might be. Charlotte. After all, Charlotte had testified at the trials of Beau's co-defendants, and there was a good chance she'd been acting as an informant before that. What if she'd told the GBI about other murders Beau had committed? What if she'd been the one to tell the GBI that Gary hadn't even been in the house when Grace was killed? It turns out I was right about the first part of that. The GBI files, when I got them, showed that Charlotte had been a cooperating witness, who'd worked closely with the GBI, and that she had in fact told the GBI about at least 3 other murders that Beau had committed, not counting the murder of Henry Ridley Jr. At first, it seemed like I hit the jackpot. If Charlotte had been telling the police about these crimes Beau had committed, about other murders he'd done, that's huge, right? But the more I learned about these cases, the more I began to question Charlotte's statements. Things didn't seem to quite add up. Was Charlotte telling the truth about Beau's crimes? Or was she falsely accusing him of murders he'd had nothing to do with? And how many murders exactly would I have to investigate in order to find the informant that Jerry Boyd had told Gary about? ¶¶
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your individual needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Now, you're going to hear an episode from me next week that involved research in Australia, and using Stamps.com's international service made life so much easier. And now it can make life easier for you, too. You, too, can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
The GBI's file for the Henry Ridley Jr. case was extensive. GBI agent Bill Dodd, the lead investigator, had been meticulous in his reports, and it turned out that Charlotte had turned informant in June of 81, just a few days after Beau was convicted. Remember, Beau's trial was the first of two trials. His co-defendants, Earl Green and Teddy Bear Mulkey, weren't convicted until December of that year. Charlotte didn't even come forward to turn state's evidence until after Beau had been convicted. In fact, Charlotte said she'd expected to be called as a defense witness, though ultimately, the defense attorney for Beau Salmon never called her. But it's fascinating in its own right that she was even considered as a defense witness, because that seems to imply that she'd told Beau, or at least Beau had believed, that she'd be willing to lie for him, under oath, on the stand. Because as shown from her testimony at the trials of Teddy Bear and Earl Green, Charlotte couldn't have truthfully testified in Beau's defense. She knew a lot about his involvement in the murder. But I also learned from the GBI file that Charlotte wasn't the only witness who had come forward to talk to them. There had been maybe a dozen informants in all. Unfortunately, while I'd been hoping perhaps that somewhere in the files there'd be something about Grace's murder, some clue about the informant that Officer Boyd had talked about, I came up empty there. In Agent Dodd's notes, there's no mention anywhere of anything having to do with Floyd County. But even if the notes from the GBI don't directly reference Grace's murder, it was hard not to see indirect references everywhere. Again and again, in reading Charlotte's statements and testimony, I'd see echoes of the murder that had happened 7 years earlier, in that house on Maple Street. The actual way that Henry Ridley Jr. had been killed up in Fort Mountain in 1980 was very different from Grace's death back in 1974. But that isn't where I saw similarities so much. According to Charlotte, Beau and Teddy Bear had taken Henry up the mountain together after getting him drunk and giving him quaaludes until he'd passed out. Beau, she said, had told her that he'd been the one who was supposed to shoot Henry, but he was stalling when it came time for it when they got to the mountain, and said he couldn't shoot Henry with him just passed out like that, until finally Teddy Bear got frustrated, grabbed the gun from Beau, and shot Henry himself. And all that could be true, for all I know. There's a lot of uncertainty in this case about how Henry was actually killed. The theory from Agent Gillis that I mentioned last week about how Henry had been shot as they walked through the woods spotlighting for deer, that makes sense to me, but from the crime scene photos, the idea that Henry had instead been laying out on the ground, passed out, and then shot in the head, that seems plausible too. On the other hand, Charlotte's story seems designed to portray Beau in as good a light as possible, given the circumstances. The idea that Beau hadn't been able to go through the killing when they were there, so Teddy Bear had to finally be willing to do it instead. Beau's still a murderer, but it makes him seem a little bit nicer, I guess. But in evaluating Charlotte's statements about the murder of Henry Ridley, there was a problem I kept running into again and again. At times, her story would deviate from what other witnesses said or what the crime scene seemed to indicate. For instance, she says Beau told her that the Ridley boy had been shot one time, but the state's other major witness, J.W. Patterson, the man Beau had recruited to help with the murder but who claimed Beau had gone ahead and done without him, he said that Beau had told him Henry had been shot three times. In reality, Henry had been shot once, but the GBI believed from the casings found that three shots had been fired up there at all. So, whose story is true, Charlotte's or J.W.'s? I don't have any way to tell, and maybe they're both true. Bo just told each of them different stories. But it was the little issues like this, all the conflicts between what Charlotte says and what others say, that left me unsure of how much to believe about what she was telling GBI. Like when Charlotte also claimed that Bo had been hired not just to kill Henry, but to kill the rest of his family as well. That Earl Green had insurance policies on his wife, Margaret, and Henry's two little brothers. And that Bo had been hired by Earl Green to take them all out one by one, so he could collect an insurance for all of them. Which again, may be true, I don't have a way of saying for sure that it's not. But in an already horrifying story, the implications of this story raised the bar to a whole new level. According to Charlotte, she knew that her husband was going to kill a 12-year-old and a 7-year-old for cash, and she was fine to sit back, say nothing, and take the money they were paid for it. But if Earl Green really did have life insurance policies on Margaret and all three of her sons, how come the only insurance records ever found were the ones on Henry? Still, one part of Charlotte's story did prove to be true. She said Bo had used Quaaludes on Henry to make the murder easier to pull off, and the blood test showed that Henry had been a little drunk at the time of his death, with a BAC of 0.11. But they also showed that another drug had been present in Henry's system. As the medical examiner testified, the blood specimen also showed an amount of methaqualone, that is, Quaaludes. This is a common, commonly abused sedative, hypnotic sleeping pill type of thing. And it was at 0.35 milligrams per a deciliter. This, in the person's blood by itself, would be suitable for ordinary routine medication. That would be less, somewhat less, than what you'd want to try and achieve if you were giving it to someone for as a tranquilizer or as sleeping pills. But combined with the alcohol, it would have a potentiating effect. That is, each would multiply the effect of the other. Quaaludes, just FYI, are not a good mix with alcohol. Even in the low amounts, relatively, that were present in Henry's blood, they could have been a problem, because combining Quaaludes with alcohol means each is worse. But Bo's fondness for using Quaaludes and other drugs on his would-be victims can be seen in Bo's other attempts to kill Henry too, the ones that failed. His first attempt to kill Henry had been when he placed Henry in a car, doused it in gasoline, and shoved it off a mountain. Henry had survived, but according to the people who talked to the GBI and testified at trial, his memory of this event had been strange and vague, to the point it was not really a memory at all. He was fuzzy on the details, and what he'd claimed was that he'd driven himself up the mountain. That he'd bought a new car from Bo Salmon, gone driving, and then something had happened. He'd gone off the road, the car had veered off, gone down a cliff, burst into flames. At one point, he told his girlfriend Lisa that he thought perhaps his cousin Larry Silvers had run him off the mountain. That maybe that's what happened to him. Henry and Larry had been having a dispute, or had one a year ago, ever since Henry had turned state's evidence on Larry in a theft case a year before. So the two of them didn't get along, and somehow, Henry got it into his head that maybe Larry and Larry's friends had been why Henry had driven himself off a mountain. Only, none of that ever happened. Larry Silvers was never involved. Henry hadn't bought a car and gone for a midnight swim. Actually, he hadn't even driven to the mountain at all. According to Charlotte, Bo and Earl Green had decided that the best way to kill Henry would be to stage an accident, as if he'd been drunk and wrecked because of that. Only Henry hadn't had a car of his own at the time. For the plan to work, he'd need to have a car somehow. So they decided to claim that Henry had bought Bo's car from him and used that one. One night, while Henry was hanging out with Bo, Henry was either given Quaaludes or had them slipped to him somehow, and then while drugged up, Bo and apparently Teddy Bear Mulkey had put Henry in the car, gone up the mountain, doused it in gasoline, and pushed off the cliff. Only Henry lived, which in other circumstances might have been a big problem for his would-be murderers. But since Henry couldn't remember how he'd come to be in the mountain, Bo and his accomplice were safe. And then there's the other failed murder attempt, the attempted overdose. Charlotte testified about how Bo had tried to make Henry overdose on morphine, but when he wouldn't inject himself anymore, he instead substituted his coke for half coke, half morphine. But Henry had gotten sick, and that plan had failed too. fact Gary couldn't remember anything about the night Grace was killed has always made it easy for his guilt to be assumed. Because any explanation other than his guilt just seems too far-fetched, too much of a conspiracy theory, like something ripped out of a bad movie. But after learning more about Henry's case, the simplest explanation for Gary's memory loss no longer seems quite so simple. Beau, it would seem, was familiar with drugging people, without their knowledge, using their drinks, in order to murder them. What if something similar had been done to Gary? After all, if Henry couldn't remember going off a mountain, well, with that possibility in mind, Gary not recalling how he drove himself home to his parents' house that night suddenly seems a lot less hard to explain. And there are other similarities, too, between Grace's murder and Henry's murder. According to Charlotte, Beau's alibi for the night that Henry was killed was pretty simple. He told her, "If the police come knocking, just tell them I've been asleep in bed all night, that I didn't know a thing about it." Which is more or less the alibi he went with in Grace's murder, too. But these similarities between Charlotte's description of Henry's murder and what we know of Grace's murder would only really be relevant if what Charlotte was saying was true. And that's something I'm no longer sure can be assumed. There is at least some objective evidence for what Charlotte says about Beau's guilt in the Henry Ridley Jr. case. Because immediately after Beau's conviction, she began talking to the GBI and telling them what she knew. She could help them build a case against Earl Green, she said. Earl was still free at the time. Even though Beau had been convicted of doing a murder that Earl had hired him for, Earl hadn't been charged. But Charlotte's story would be enough if it had something to corroborate it. So finally, they got Charlotte to wear a wire and to go talk to Earl about the murder, get him to implicate himself somehow. So in late June 1981, that's what she did. The transcript of Charlotte's conversation with Earl Green is one of those intercepted communications that you end up having to just assume made sense to the parties, because from the outside looking in, there are all kinds of references and asides that don't seem to make any sense at all. I still don't know what half the things Charlotte and Earl talked about even mean. But portions of it are clear. Clear enough to conclude that there was a financial arrangement between Beau and Earl, and that Earl needed to pay Beau back in connection with Henry's murder. As Charlotte told Earl at one point, "He said that you know that the money was supposed to have been paid before he went to court." And Earl said, "Yeah, yeah." Charlotte told him, "So I told him I'd come tell ya, and I'll tell ya." And Earl tried to reassure her. "Well, I'll get it up tomorrow. I thought I'd have it Wednesday." In some way or another, Earl promised Charlotte, he'd get her the money that he owed Beau in connection with killing Henry, and he'd bring it to her in an unmarked brown bag, just to keep it discreet. And then Earl also seemed to tell Charlotte that he planned to lay the whole murder on Margaret, his wife, Henry's mother, to blame her for Henry's death because, quote, she's dumb as hell, and he's, quote, gonna make it out like Margaret had it done, like it wasn't Beau, it was somebody else. In other words, he was gonna tell the cops that Margaret had been discussing hiring some other hitman, not Beau, to kill Henry. And Earl seemed to think that this devious plan would somehow get law enforcement off his trail. But one of the more damning exchanges of the whole conversation comes from a comment from Charlotte that's kind of a throwaway. More of a wistful complaint. She told Earl, "This wasn't supposed to happen. He wasn't supposed to have to go to jail." And Earl told her, "He shouldn't have. I don't see how in the hell they ever got him." It's a little indirect, for sure, but the way they talk, it's clear Earl and Charlotte don't think Beau got arrested for nothing. They're just surprised the state managed to convict him.
Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio products. Here are some of the reasons why I think Audible is the best solution for digital audiobooks. Membership includes one free audiobook a month, exclusive sales of 30% off all regularly priced audiobooks, and unlimited access to the channel's content. Plus, there's free apps for iPhone, iPad, Android, and Windows Phone. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. Finally, there's the Great Listen Guarantee. You didn't like it? You can swap it. Now, luckily, this wasn't the case for me with my recent purchase. It was Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, as narrated by Will Wheaton. It's about a dystopian future in which the key to solving a contest is knowledge of 80s pop culture. If, like me, you love pop culture, you'll love this book. And now Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. You can download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed. That's audible.com/undisclosed and get started today.
At the time that Charlotte wore the wire to her conversation with Earl Green, she'd only told the GBI about Henry's murder. She'd refused to give them any info about Beau's other crimes, though it seems clear they'd questioned her about it. But then, a couple weeks later, GBI agent Bill Dodd had been asleep in his house one night when he woke up to a phone call at 3:05 in the morning, and it was Charlotte. She was ready to give the GBI more info, she said, about the Ridley murder, and also about some other murders Beau had done besides. According to Dodd's report, Charlotte stated the reason she had not furnished this information sooner was that she had feared for her life and that she did not want to testify against Beau in court. She stated now it didn't matter because Beau didn't care anything about her. Despite the lateness of the hour, Agent Dodd had immediately sprung into action. I can only assume he'd wanted to get Charlotte in for an interview before she changed her mind again. So by 3:20 a.m., Dodd had picked Charlotte up and taken her to the police station, where she was interviewed, and told Dodd about three other murders that Beau had done. As recorded in Dodd's files, Charlotte stated that Beau, Salmon, and Teddy Bear had killed Jack Patton and Bill Kelly. Charlotte stated Beau and another subject, believed to be Teddy Bear or Pistol Whitener, had also killed Albert Klein and put his car in the river. Charlotte stated the reason Patton and Kelly were killed was mainly because of her. Charlotte stated Beau had threatened on several occasions to kill Patton and Kelly for fooling around with her. She stated Beau had also threatened to kill her if she ever told anything she knew in reference to any of the murders. Charlotte stated Albert Klein was killed for a $10,000 contract, and she had heard Billy Mathis make the contract with Beau. Charlotte stated she had seen Billy Mathis give Beau a brown envelope a few days later in the kitchen of the residence. After Mathis had left, Beau went into the bathroom with the brown envelope. Charlotte stated that when Beau came out of the bathroom, he'd had several $100 bills. Charlotte stated that the reason for the contract on Klein was that he'd taken close to $20,000 to $25,000 from them to purchase drugs. But after Klein purchased the drugs, he told them it wasn't any good. Klein had told them that the people he had sold the drugs to wanted their money back. Charlotte stated that she'd heard Klein had kept all the money, amounting to close to $100,000. Charlotte stated Beau told her he had shot Klein twice in the head with a .38 caliber pistol and killed him. Charlotte stated when Beau had talked about the murder, he had said they. She stated for this reason, she felt like Pistol or Teddy Bear was with them. She stated it was probably Teddy Bear because Beau could snap his fingers and Teddy Bear would jump. Charlotte stated that the gun that was used to kill Patton and Kelly was a .32 revolver, which Beau had gotten from Johnny Vaughn at the Sportsman's Tavern, and a .22 pistol, which Teddy Bear had, which she understood was stolen. Charlotte stated that she'd been to the cemetery with Beau, where Patton and Kelly were killed, and also to the location where Klein's car had been found. She stated Beau had told her about how everything had happened. She stated that Beau had never told her where Albert Klein's body was located. Charlotte stated that Beau would always say that they would never find his body. Of the three victims that Charlotte told Agent Dodd about, I recognized one of the names right away, Jack Patton. Him I knew because he'd one of Beau's closest friends. Jack was the one who'd helped Beau light a man on fire in 1966. But I hadn't even known that Jack had been murdered, let alone that Beau had been accused of killing him. And the two other names, Billy Kelly and Albert Klein, I'd never even heard before. I realized I would need to go to Dalton if I wanted to learn more. And since I hadn't spent much time up in Dalton Chatsworth, I didn't know much about the towns and wasn't sure where to start. By chance and luck, though, it turned out I did have a contact who knew the area. I met Dawn last year at a meetup for our season 2 case. She lived a little ways north of Rome, and she told me if we ever needed help from someone local to the area, to let her know. At the time, I just started looking into Gary Mitchum Reeves' case, and when I realized that Murray and Winfield counties had court records I'd be needing, I asked Dawn for help, and she was able to track down court files and get copies. She also agreed to help me out with what I spend probably most of my time doing when I'm out investigating a case. Getting lost while trying to find witnesses to interview.
There we go.
That says 1816. Okay, so then maybe 1802 is... see, this is 1816.
Okay, yeah, so it's the one next there. Wait.
Very confusing.
Did you see an 1802 in that one, though?
And while I hadn't realized it at first, when I asked for Dawn's help, it turned out that her husband, Joseph, was an attorney in Dalton. And while he hadn't been around practicing back in 1980, once he saw the court files I was looking at, he knew what attorneys I needed to be talking to if I wanted to find out more about these cases, and what questions I needed to be asking them. That's how I found out that Charlotte's statements about the murders that Beau had committed, or allegedly committed, might not be quite what they seemed. Like I said, I'd never heard the name Albert Klein before I got the GBI file from the Henry Ridley case. And before my first trip to Dalton, I just assumed that he was someone Beau had killed. Because during the GBI's investigation into Ridley's death, 5 different witnesses had come forward and claimed they knew something about how a man named Albert Klein had been killed, and how either Beau Salmon or someone he knew had been the ones to do it. The first witness was Confidential Informant 166. She'd given the agents information about the Ridley killing, but also said she had information about other murders Beau had done, though she was scared to tell them anything more than she already had. The GBI report read, CI 166 stated more information could be given in reference to the Ridley, Patton, Kelly, and Klein case at another time. CI 166 was afraid of being seen this time, and was sure of being killed if they learned of the information being furnished by her. The next informant, CI 167, took it a step further. Not only did this witness know that Beau had been involved in Klein's murder, the witness also knew what Beau had done with the body. And CI 167 had a rough idea of where to find it. The GBI's report read, on Thursday, February 19, 1981, CI 167 met with Special Agent Dodd and accompanied him on a 4-hour search for a well located in the lower end of Whitfield County, where CI 167 had heard Albert Klein was thrown after being shot. The location was located where CI 167 had gone with Beau Salmon, Jack Patton, and Billy Kelly about 3 years earlier, and this was supposed to be the location. CI 167 stated they never went to the well, but stayed at the location pointed out. CI 167 stated that Beau would always walk there to the well and be gone about 20 to 25 minutes before returning. Unfortunately, after the search, they had nothing. CI 167 knew the well was somewhere in South Whitfield County, but they couldn't actually find the spot where they'd been before. So the Klein investigation remained open. Then, about 6 months later, after Beau had been convicted of Henry's murder, Earl Green and Teddy Bear Mulkey were charged in it as well. Mulkey's girlfriend, who I'll call Louise, came forward and told the GBI that Mulkey had information they'd be interested in. And since she didn't want Mulkey going down for the murder Beau had already been convicted of, she was looking to set up a deal on Mulkey's behalf. According to the report, Louise asked if she and Teddy Bear could furnish information as to the person who had killed Klein and where his body was located. Would it help Mulkey reference the charges against him? Agent Dodd advised Louise he could not make any promises, but he was sure, if she had valuable information, the district attorney would take this into consideration. Louise stated that she knew Teddy Bear did not have anything to do with the murders, but he might have heard something that might be helpful. But when the GBI went to Teddy Bear Mulkey and asked him about it, he wouldn't talk. Finally, he agreed to say something about the Albert Klein case, but he couldn't tell him where the body was. According to the report, Mulkey stated he did not wish to talk about the Ridley case. After being questioned at length in reference to the Patton, Kelly, and Klein case, he stated Beau had told him that a guy by the name of Ken and his wife were the people who had killed Klein. Mulkey stated he did not know Ken's last name. Mulkey stated Ken and his wife were con people. Yeah, I still don't know who Ken and his wife, the con people, are, and you don't need to worry about that for now. What was interesting, though, is that even though Mulkey couldn't talk about the Ridley case, he did agree to take a polygraph with regards to the other cases. Per the report, on Friday, September 25th, 1981, Harold Wayne Mulkey signed a stipulation and submitted to a polygraph test, reference Patton, Kelly, and Klein cases. Upon completion, the polygraph operator advised that he believed Mulkey was truthful when he said he had nothing to do with Patton, Kelly, and Klein cases. The agent advised that he did get a reaction when he asked if Mulkey knew who had killed the three. The agent stated he would have to say the test was inconclusive. Polygraphs are close to meaningless, and I can't put any stock whatsoever in the actual conclusions the operator got. But still, what I find surprising, and what I can't help but be tempted to read some meaning into, is the fact Mulkey agreed to the test at all, but only with regards to the Patton, Kelly, and Klein murders, not the Ridley case. If Mulkey had been confident in his ability to beat a polygraph, wouldn't he have maybe tried to use it to deny the Ridley murder as well? The fact he agreed to answer questions about three cases, but not the fourth, might suggest he regarded the other cases differently. Or maybe it's nothing at all, and it's meaningless polygraph stuff. Either way, these four witnesses provided a foundation that, to me, at least initially, made Charlotte's story about Albert Klein sound believable. And when questioned by police about Klein's murder, here's what Charlotte said. Investigating officers in Charlotte went to the location of the recovery of Albert Klein's vehicle. Charlotte showed where the car had been pushed into the river. Charlotte stated that the car was supposed to have gone out of sight, but the car had gotten caught in a stump or the bank and would not go all the way into the river. Charlotte stated that as they started back towards the vehicle, Beau told her to follow him. She stated they walked across a short patch of woods just before coming out of the woods into a freshly plowed field. Beau told her to stay behind him because there were wells out there. Charlotte stated they walked across the freshly plowed field, where the dirt was very soft, up a small rise, and she asked Beau if Klein was out there in a well, and he said, "You're close." Charlotte stated Beau was walking through the field, looking around on the ground, as if he was looking for something. Then he stopped and picked up something from the dirt which sparkled in the sunlight. She said Beau wiped it off and put it in his pocket and then said, "Let's go." Charlotte stated that when she questioned Beau about the location, he said Jack Patton had shown him the location, that they had gone fishing there on several occasions. Charlotte stated that prior to the recovery of Klein's car, Beau came home one night, very muddy, up to his knees and on his shirt. She stated that it seemed to be the same type of red mud that was in the field investigating officers had just visited. She stated the clothes were stained so severely that she was unable to get all the mud out. Charlotte stated that on the day Beau was arrested for the Ridley murder, he was wearing a t-shirt that he had worn the night he had gotten so muddy. Now, Charlotte's statement has a few red flags in it, like that thing about the shiny thing on the ground. Apparently, it was a diamond ring or something, but what are the odds that Beau would have just happened to find some random ring in the dirt after taking Charlotte on a tour of a murder scene that was for a murder he'd committed? Seriously? But while the story is odd, you can see why, after reading the whole of the GBI report, I came to the conclusion that Beau likely had killed a guy named Albert Klein. I mean, that's what Charlotte said, and what informants 166 and 167 said. And Beau's co-defendant in the Henry Ridley murder also claimed to have known about Albert being killed. So whatever happened to this Albert Klein guy, it seemed like it must have involved Beau, right? But who was Albert Klein? Had he really been murdered? Had his body ever been found? What was all this about? I didn't have much to go on at first. I couldn't find hardly anything online. I was able to confirm that on November 2nd, 1980, Klein's car had been found in the Conasauga River, pretty much exactly how Charlotte had described. And death index records confirmed that a man named Albert Klein from Whitfield County had died almost 2 years later, on August 19, 1982. My guess at the time was that the family had given up on finding him after his car was down in the river, so they had petitioned to have his death declared or something, and that's why the death was so much later than the cars showing up in the river. But after the internet trail ran cold, it did seem to me that Albert Klein must have never been found, that his body must still be in a well somewhere, where Beau had dumped him. Before making my first trip to Dalton, I joked with Dawn about how she better be ready to go tramping in the fields because we're going to find that well. Okay, I wasn't entirely kidding, which is why I was almost disappointed when Joseph gave me the news. The Whitfield County well hunt was called off. Albert Klein's body had been found. The mystery had been solved. But the answer was a lot different than what I expected.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time to go for free, ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed.
Leslie Waycaster is the attorney that represented Teddy Bear Mulkey when he was tried for Henry's murder. That's originally why I'd wanted to talk to him. But it turned out that he'd also been part of the Klein case.
There was another case where my former partner, Greg Melton, and I represented a fellow who was accused of murdering a guy named Albert Klein.
And Leslie told me that Albert Klein's body had been found in a well in South Whitfield County in August 1982. Long after Beau and Teddy Bear and Earl Green had all been convicted and sent away for the Henry Ridley murder. And not only had Albert Klein's body been found, some guy I'd never even heard of had been convicted for his murder. Beau Salmon had nothing to do with it.
So I don't know the timing of when the body was found, but the files I have, I think, are before the body got recovered. And Beau's wife was telling authorities that he'd killed Albert Klein and dumped him in a well in southern Whitfield County.
Well, the part of being dumped in a well is correct, but the rest of it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the record, I'm not telling you anything that's not in the public record. Mike admitted that he shot him, said it was in self-defense.
I was kind of shocked when Leslie told me this, because based on what Charlotte had said and the other witnesses, I had been expecting the Albert Klein case to involve a still-missing body, and I'd assumed it was established fact that Beau or someone close to Beau had been responsible. I'd been thinking that maybe since Klein's body had never turned up, the state had decided that a no-body prosecution would be too difficult and hadn't pursued it, and anyway, Beau already had a life sentence, so why bother? But when I got to Dalton, it turned out that a guy named Mike had confessed to the crime and been convicted of it and done his time and been released long ago.
Sure. Mike's a very nice guy. He's recovered well, and he's doing well. And I saw his sister not long ago. She said he's made something of his life over the last 25 years. He just got in a bad crowd. I mean, this was a bad crowd.
Albert Klein had been part of a bad crowd. And given Albert's reputation, it doesn't seem like it was much of a surprise to anyone that he ended up getting shot. I mean, he'd been shot at a few times before. This was just the first time the shooter hadn't missed. And Albert Klein was not much loved in Dalton. Attorney Marcus Morris, who had been a prosecutor in Dalton back in those days, told me a story about one of the incidents he remembered. One that was in line with a lot of the things I'd hear about Albert Klein.
And there was a girl in there, and Albert put something in her drink, did something to kind of drug her some way. This is a true story. And anyhow, he basically picked her up and went across Walnut Avenue, and there was a vacant lot there. And she still had her faculties enough about her to try to struggle to get away. And somebody intervened. I can't tell you what happened, but anyhow, he was arrested for that.
There were other incidents like that, too, so it's not really a surprise that Albert's disappearance wasn't the cause of too much distress in Dalton.
Really, It's kind of like Mike Lau did a public service, so to speak, you know.
Sure.
Because Elbert was a bad fellow.
And the then sheriff of Whitfield County, Jack Davis, testified on Mike's behalf as a character witness. That's why I say, if Mike had picked up the phone when it happened and said, I just killed Elbert Klein, they might have said, well, the parade will start at 4 o'clock, you know, or something. I mean, I doubt he'd been prosecuted. I doubt he would have been prosecuted.
Mike wasn't someone that anyone I spoke to would have expected to be caught up in something like this. So what had actually happened? Leslie Waycaster, Mike's attorney, couldn't tell me any specifics about his involvement in the case, but he was able to give me a summary of what was already in the public record.
There was a hung jury. So then we entered into a deal where Mike pled to a lesser offense of some degree of manslaughter. There was a couple of different ones in Georgia, and I don't remember which one it was. So he entered a plea to that, and he had already served some time, and he may have had to serve a little bit more, but ultimately, and my recollection is ultimately he served about a year for that.
What was the evidence against him, do you recall? Was it?
Well, Mike never denied shooting the guy. He said it was in self-defense. So it was really a question for the jury as to whether or not it was self-defense. There was a gun. It was over a drug deal that had gone bad. Mike was a very nice guy, but he was kind of down on his luck. But he and Elbert Klein were in a car. They got into a fight. Elbert had a gun with him somehow or another. Elbert was physically a much bigger guy than Mike. But somehow or another, Mike got his hands on the gun and he shot him. And that's why I said earlier, if he had called the police right then, what the police knew about Elbert Klein, there would be no doubt that Mike would have been believed about self-defense. It was hiding the body for 2 years and keeping his mouth shut that got him in trouble.
According to Mike, Elbert had come to his house one day, and Mike had gotten in the car to talk to him. When Elbert found out that Mike didn't have the money to pay him back, things had turned violent. Elbert and Mike, still in the car, had gotten into a struggle, and the much larger Elbert Klein was strangling Mike. Mike had been able to grab Elbert's gun and then somehow shot and killed him, and then Mike had panicked. In hindsight, he should have called 911, but instead he hid the body in the woods and tried to figure out what to do. First thing he did was dispose of the car. He called a friend and claimed that he was trying to get rid of Elbert Klein's car from as part of an insurance scam, and together they drove to the river and drove the car in. But unfortunately for Mike, it didn't sink all the way. It got caught in something and was still visible, so it was spotted the next day. When investigators recovered the car and found a gunshot in the driver's side door and bloodstains on the passenger side seat and a .38 slug on the floor of the car, they assumed things hadn't gone great for Elbert. Mike had more success in disposing of Elbert's body. He'd been able to transport it to a nearby well, close to his house, one that presumably, or hopefully, was no longer in use, where he dumped it in. And that was that. For nearly 2 years, Mike says, the topic just never came up. He never told a soul about what he'd done, and he tried to move on with his life. And then, August 1982, the police found Elbert Klein's body. Marcus Morris, the former prosecutor in Dalton who I spoke to, remembered when that had happened.
Later on, Elbert was missing.
Was he reported missing?
Mm-hmm. No. He was missing. And Jack Davis was the sheriff at that time. And Jack Davis, I believe, received information, and I'm not sure who his source was, that Elbert Klein was buried in a well at a certain place. And they went and actually dug a parallel shaft in that well and found Elbert's body in there.
After finding Elbert's bloodstained car in the river and him being missing for the next 2 years, it wasn't really a surprise Elbert was dead. But as for how the body was found then, that's still a mystery. Someone tipped off Sheriff Jack Davis that Elbert Klein's body was in the well, But who the informant was isn't recorded anywhere, and not even Mike's defense knew that.
Do you know how the body was found? Do you call that?
I don't. It seems like the police had somebody that called them and said, hey, you need to go look in this well on this property where Mike, I don't know if Mike was still living there, but there's a well on the property and you need to go look in there. That's where the body is. So they got a tip and they went, and sure enough, that's where it was.
Huh.
I never knew who it was that tipped the police off. We surmised that Mike told somebody. But we were just trying to look for ways as to how, after that body's been in a well for almost 2 years, how all of a sudden somebody knows where it's at.
So how the sheriff learned where Albert Klein's body was is still a mystery, but it seems like the rest of the case was more or less resolved. None of the attorneys I spoke to in Dalton had any doubts about it.
Bo might want to claim that he killed him, but Mike killed him.
What makes you so confident in that belief?
That Mike killed him?
Yes, sir.
I don't know why Mike would go to prison, okay, you know, and admit he did something. I mean, Mike Loud had not really been in trouble, didn't have a very bad record at all. He's young. He's a real young guy at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mike did serve time for the killing, and any prison time is a serious deal, especially for a young guy like Mike who had no prior record. He did end up getting early release, though.
My understanding is that, and I don't know how long he served. I don't know how long, but he didn't complete that sentence. I think he was...
He got 5 years. I think he served no more than two.
Right. So he... Somebody got involved and got him paroled out. Let's just say that. You could do that at that time. Not many people know it. Can't do that today. Hmm. But it wasn't... Nobody ever intended, I think, for that to happen to Mike.
Based on Mike's conviction, it was starting to seem an awful lot like Bo Salmon had nothing to do with Albert Klein's murder. But if so, then what could explain Charlotte and the statement she made? Remember, she described in detail to the GBI how Bo had confessed to her to the murder of Albert Klein, and she gave a kind of complicated backstory to explain how it happened. In fact, he'd taken her to the murder site as he narrated what he'd done. This isn't a case where it's possible she could be mistaken. Either Bo killed Albert Klein and Charlotte told the police the truth, or Charlotte made up a story to frame Bo for Klein's murder for some unknown reason. So, which is it? I can kind of buy, perhaps, that Charlotte was just mad at Bo because he'd been convicted and was going away for life, and maybe she was trying to frame him for as many murders as possible because of reasons. But it's not just Bo she implicated in the murder, remember. She said a guy named Bill Mathis had been the one who'd hired Bo to do the hit, and that Pistol Whitener, or maybe Teddy Bear, had helped him carry it out. And if Charlotte would so easily implicate people in murders they had nothing to do with, is it really too much of a leap to wonder if she could have done the same to Gary at his trial? I was still mulling over the question of why Charlotte had falsely accused Bo of Klein's murder when Dawn and I made a trip to Whitfield County Courthouse to collect files in a different criminal case, one where Bo and Teddy Bear had been convicted of being hired to burn down a local bar. But while there, we decided to pull Albert Klein's case too, just to see. And what we found there made me realize I wasn't nearly as close to finding an answer in the Albert Klein case as I'd imagined. When we got back from the court, we updated Joseph on what we'd found in the court file, and in particular, what had been in the autopsy report.
He said that actually he did that to make it look like Klein was trying to get insurance money off his car. But tell him what the body was like when they got it out of that well.
So it was badly burned all over, and there was a noose around the body's neck, and there was at least one gunshot.
Boy.
Hands tied behind his back.
Yeah, the case file presented a very different picture from what I'd imagined. The file was thin and had nothing on the crime scene itself, but the tale the autopsy told was vivid enough. Klein had died from a single gunshot wound to the back, which was what I'd expected, but everything else in the report was not. It said, victim reported missing, 11-2-80. Search in progress since that date. Body found in well, rope around neck, hands tied. Grade all used to remove corpse. This is a markedly decomposed body of a white male measuring 70 inches. The body surface has extensive black charring, indicating fire effect. There is a green rope noose around the neck. The file also had a confession from Mike that he'd given to Sheriff Jack Davis the night he was arrested. And the story that's told there is basically exactly what all the attorneys have described to me. The struggle in the car, Mike grabbing the gun and firing, then panicking, not knowing what to do, dumping the body in a well, and then nothing for 2 years until it was found. I think it's fair to say that there are some inconsistencies here. Though the confession had made some attempts to incorporate the details from the autopsy report, there's no mention at all of the hands tied behind the back, and nothing to explain the other things that had been found. There was a line in the confession where Mike claimed, "The rope tied around the neck was where I tried to drag him." And there's mention of fire. It says, "Sometime after my house burned down, there was some trash outside. My father and I took the trash and put it in the well. My father operated the front end loader while I put the trash into the well. Elbert's shoes were thrown into the well." Okay, sure. Maybe that's how the body was burned. Maybe the house burned down and they poured burning trash into a well and the corpse got burned a year after it was put there. Only not really, because the well had water in it. So even if burning wood was tossed into the well with a front end loader, it still doesn't explain why the body was burned. And there were other parts of the confession, too, that were confusing. Like this section, where Mike described what he did with the body after the murder. "I began thinking about burying the body, but I couldn't. I waited till dark and walked down to where the body was. I took a blanket with me. Also some ski rope. The blanket was actually a slipcover for a sofa. I wrapped the body in it." That last line, with the sudden correction, stood out to me, as did a few other lines in the confession. Lines where the story had started to go off track from the evidence, followed by a quick fix to bring it back on track. Plus, a few parts that just didn't make any sense at all. Mike's confession says that he wrapped the body in a sofa cover. Sorry, a blanket that was actually a sofa cover. And then he put the noose around the neck to help move the body. So maybe he wrapped everything up, except for the head, and then used the head to attach a tow rope? I guess? Maybe? But Mike moved the body by putting it in the trunk of his car, so how was the rope around the neck helping with that? I was left more confused than before. Was Mike's confession true, or was there more going on here? The way things stood, the truth or falsity of Charlotte's statements to the police was kind of in limbo. It seemed like her statements were probably false, that she'd lied and accused Beau and Billy Mathis and Pistol Whitener and Teddy Bear Mulkey of the murder they hadn't done, but I couldn't really conclude that for sure because there were just so many holes in the story. I couldn't quite rule out the possibility that more had gone on here, that maybe Beau really had been involved and Charlotte was telling the truth. And since I was out of other options, I decided to talk to Mike. When I called Mike, he was, understandably, not particularly eager to recall details of a really bad time in his life. But he was patient and willing to answer my questions. Yes, he said, he'd killed Elbert. He'd stupidly gotten into drugs, and that night he'd stupidly gotten into the car with Elbert. That evening back in 1980. At first, they just talked. But Elbert had gotten angry when Mike said he couldn't pay him back yet, and he'd gotten violent, choking Mike and slamming his head against the side of the window. They'd struggled, and at some point, Mike had gotten a hold of Elbert's gun and just kind of blindly fired. It all happened so fast, he didn't really know what happened, but when it was over, one shot had gone through the car's roof and one shot had gone through Elbert. That part all made sense. It all lined up with what I'd heard from their sources. But then I asked him about what I'd read in the autopsy report, about the burning. And Mike said I'd had it wrong. No, that's not right. That was not burned. Not unless someone took the guy out of the well and burned him, then put him back in. That body wasn't burned. And when I told him about the autopsy report and about the ropes, his reaction was, no way. Like, surprised. As in, no way, that's what the file said. No one ever mentioned that to me, he told me. He seemed completely surprised and baffled. Just as confused as I was. Was I sure I had the right reports, he asked? I must have gotten this case mixed up with another one. There were other murders at the time that he remembered vaguely from seeing news reports. Maybe that file had gotten mixed with this one, and I was reading off an autopsy report from some other case entirely. Because what I was telling him couldn't be true. He'd never heard any of this before, and he had no answers for me. The body hadn't been burned, there were no ropes that he could recall, and that's just not how it happened. After I talked to Mike, I told Dawn and Joseph about my conversation with him, and how I'd come away believing what Mike had said, even if the story he had told me hadn't made any sense.
So I finally talked to the guy convicted of killing Albert Klein, and he seemed very credible. He said he did it. And then I tried to tell him about the condition of the body, you know, the burning and the noose and the hands on the back. And he was trying to convince me that there's no way in hell that happened, because he knows for a fact that the body wasn't burned, and there wasn't no noose, and there wasn't no hands tied by the back. And he seems believable. So now, like, I'm kind of wondering, did they, like, have two bodies in the well, and they pulled up the wrong one? He could just be a really good liar, and maybe I'm falling for it. I don't know. But when I told him about the, like, the autopsy, his, like, immediate response was, like, you got the wrong file, you're looking at the wrong thing. And I had to, like, insist, like, actually, no, I swear this is the right file. It is the Albert Klein file, and it says this is how he died. And he was just, it really seemed like the first time he was ever hearing that, and he seemed very baffled. And he was like, that doesn't make any sense at all, because I can guarantee that body was not burned. So I told him about how maybe it was, like, the burning brush was put in after. The fact is, like, the well was full of water. You can't burn a body in a well full of water, which, I mean, he has a point.
Dawn and Joseph weren't buying it, though. Yeah, maybe Mike had convinced me he was credible, but that doesn't change the fact that his story is at odds with the actual findings of an independent medical examiner.
I don't know. I don't buy it. I think he's been telling the same story for 40 years, and it's too damn late to change it now. I think that's where the body was bound, the body was burned. If he says it wasn't, what he's saying doesn't line up with the truth. Again, I think he's telling the same story that he's told for 40 years, and it's just too late now for him to change.
Maybe he has a really good reason for claiming that he murdered Klein and has just convinced himself that that's the truth, and that's why he seems credible. Or, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how the reports of how the body was could be so wrong. Like, I don't know, it's one or the other.
And this is where I get caught up in an endless circle. I have no good reason to disbelieve Mike's story, and I have no good reason to disbelieve the autopsy report. But one of them is absolutely wrong. I guess there is one explanation, that Mike did do the murder, but in a way that fits the autopsy. But as easy as an explanation that might be, or might sound like, I don't believe it could be true either, for a variety of reasons. And it also doesn't explain why Mike's description of the crime scene is wrong in so many confusing and basic ways. And it also doesn't explain why, a year and a half before Albert's body was found, 5 different witnesses came forward and told the GBI, during the course of the Ridley murder investigation, that they had knowledge of who'd killed Albert Klein. And none of them named Mike. None of them even seemed to have known Mike. Several of them had also known the body was in a well in South Whitfield County, which is where the body did turn out to be, and I refused to believe that was just a lucky guess on their part. They'd known something. The question is how. If we knew who the informant was that had tipped off the location of Klein's body, that might give us an answer. Unfortunately, it's not listed in any file I've seen, but there were some circumstantial facts that made me think we might have a clue about who it was. Albert's body was found on August 19th, 1982. Now, a year before that, in September of 1981, Teddy Bear Mulkey's girlfriend had tried to set up a deal with the GBI, where in exchange for getting help with his case, he'd tell them where Albert Klein's body was and who had killed him. But Mulkey had backed away from the deal and gone to trial instead, where he'd been convicted, gotten a life sentence, and gone out to prison. The next year, he filed a motion for a new trial, and a hearing was scheduled for August 11th, 1982. So Mulkey was transported back to Whitfield County for it, and on August 19th, 1982, Mulkey's motion for a new trial was denied. That same day, an informant's tip led the sheriff to Klein's body in that well in South Whitfield County. Now, there's no proof that there's a connection there, but again, the coincidence seems interesting. Mulkey had allegedly known where Klein's body was and had considered telling the police about it in exchange for a deal. A year later, he was back in Whitfield for a motion for a new trial, and the same day it gets denied, the police found Klein's body. Had Mulkey gotten desperate and tried to see if maybe in exchange for tipping off the body's location, he could get a new trial? There's one person who'd know the answer to that question for sure. Teddy Bear Mulkey. He'd been paroled from prison a few years ago, and while I thought it was doubtful he'd talk to me, I had to try. So Don and I tracked him down, knocking on doors where we thought he might live, and at first we came up empty. Finally, though, we got to an address where a man opened the door, and when I asked if I could talk to Mulkey, the man told me no, he didn't live there, but by luck, he could help us out. Mulkey, he said, was his ex-brother-in-law, and he hadn't seen the man in 26 years, but he knew an address where we could probably find him. So off we went, but the address that we'd been given turned out not to exist, and the neighbors we talked to there had no idea what house we were talking about or this man Mulkey. Our wild goose chase got us no closer to finding him. Finally, we gave up. That's when I told Don about a sneaking suspicion I'd had about the man we'd spoken to. Yeah, I don't think that was Mulkey's brother-in-law.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that was Mulkey.
Wow.
He don't have no brother-in-law.
Oh my goodness.
That was so him, and he was, He was so confident about it.
Put God on his feet.
I know. And he gave us like a... But like, you can tell because he made up an address, but like, he used one he already knew where he used to live kind of, right. And just changed it. Yeah, well, I'm not going to go back. He's clearly not interested in talking.
Oh, yeah.
So, if Mulkey has any answers, he's not sharing them. But Albert Klein is only the first of three murders that Charlotte blamed Beau for. And even if her claims about Klein's death are uncertain... What about the other two? Those men, Jack Patton and Billy Kelly, had been friends of Beau's, and in 1979, they'd been found dead in a cemetery. They'd been ambushed and gunned down in a hail of bullets, and the murder was never solved. Charlotte said Beau had killed them, and since I still needed to find that GBI informant who knew about Grace's murder, off I went on another murder investigation. And if I'm being honest, at this point, it wasn't just about Gary's case or what had happened in Floyd County. I wanted to understand who Beau had been and just how all of this could have happened. If Beau had really killed all these people, and if so, why it had taken so long to stop him. As I would come to learn, the families of Billy Kelly and Jack Patton have been grappling with these same questions for a long time.
So you knew Beau?
Yeah.
What was he like?
From my younger days, they called him Hitman because he got paid to take people out.
That's all for episode 6 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Gary Mitchum Reeves. We'll be back next week with episode 7, and stay tuned this Thursday for a bonus episode of Undisclosed brought to you by Colin. If you'd like to read episode transcripts or check out our people map to help keep track of who's who in this case, we've got you covered. They're on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. Special thanks for this episode goes out to Lisa Harris with the GBI for her assistance in tracking down old case files. And a huge thanks goes out to Don and Joseph Evans for all of their help in investigating this case. Methil Telhan is our behind-the-scenes jack-of-all-trades who did all the million and one things it took to bring you this episode. And our sound editor is Rebecca Lavoie, who is legion when it comes to podcasting. But among her many shows, the fantastic Crime Writers On. Check it out.